obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I'm Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I don't like lecterns. These were built many, 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 many years ago to protect politicians from people like us. Because we had spears and arrows and rocks. Right? I'm not kidding. And I really do feel that they kind of block, you know, the vibe. I can't tell you what a great-looking bunch of people this is. Whoa! Southern California AA. You know, I got to thank the South Bay Roundup crew for pulling this together. I was absolutely shocked, humbled, and flattered when they asked me to be the main speaker at a musicians' meeting. And I can't thank my dear friend, sometime mentor, and sometime musical collaborator, Denny S. He was here last year for you. How about a big hand for Denny? I didn't know he was coming. And it's been just a joy to share the journey with Denny. And before I say anything else, I got to thank specifically Diane, Mike, Chuck, Christine, I think, who was calling me. And the gift bag is ridiculous. We might as well be at the Grammys or something. Wow. And I saw my dear friend Carrie White. Some of you may know her. If you're a Facebook friend of hers, she never breaks her anonymity on Facebook, which is a really good thing. Central Office says social media, no mention of AA. But yesterday she let us know she has 10 grandchildren, and she took a picture of them, all gifts to the program. She's been sober a long time. The day before that, she let us know she was Miss November 1963. Right? Playboy Bunny, 10 grandchildren. Great. She also said, what are you doing this weekend? You want to go to barbecue? You got any plans? What are you doing? And I said, I've been humbled and flattered to be the speaker down at the South Bay Roundup for the musicians meeting. And she said, well, you know, Paul, you might want to consider wearing colors. It's summer, and you tend to look like Uncle Fester on crack. Because if you've ever heard Carrie speak, she'll tell you, I'm here to tell you, this is me speaking in Carrie's first voice. I'm here to tell you what it was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. But what's really important is what we wore, what happened, what are we wearing now? And before we go any further, I need from the heart to honor my first sponsor, who died sober with many, many, many years of sobriety. Marv G. I also want to honor a handful of men who, without them, I definitely wouldn't have made it. I would have been a statistic. I have a fatal variety of alcoholism. And those gentlemen are, not in any particular order, but Doug F. Doug Feiger got sober in his living room on Wednesday nights. My grand sponsor for many, many years, Bob T. Dallas T., who's still a big part of my sobriety, and Tony S. I'm going to tell you a little story. I was about a month sober, and I was not into it. I wasn't getting it. And I was sitting outside our Wednesday night meeting. It had moved to the YMCA in Hollywood, and it was a round robin. And I was sitting on the steps, and the meeting was starting, and Tony was having a cigarette. And he said, come on, let's go in. And I said, nope, can't go in there anymore, man. Can't do it. It's not for me. He said, wait a minute, aren't you an alcoholic? I said, yeah. He said, as a result of your alcoholism, didn't you get addicted to heroin and cocaine? And I said, that's correct. He said, I think you need to be in that room. Why don't you come in? I said, I can't do it. I can't. I've been lying to those guys. I've been telling those guys that I've got 18 months when I don't have 30 days. Because I'll tell you a little story. My Eskimo was a very interesting person. He brought me to Doug's house, and he said, just tell everybody you have 18 months, and I'm your sponsor. That'll keep them away from you. It worked. a bit sociopathic, but it worked. He will remain nameless. Doesn't, you know, ain't going to help anybody know who that guy is. Anyway, and Tony said, well, just go in the room, sit down, take your seat. When it comes around to you, tell him how much time you got. I said, oh, I can't do that. I've been late. He said, trust me, you're going to be fine. And he walked me into that room and he sat me down and he sat next to me. And by the grace of God, through the prayers of many, many people, my family, people inside and outside of the rooms, the sharing went to Tony first and then to me. And he nudged me and he looked at me and winked. And I told everybody what was they were painfully aware of, you know. When you're calling the big book the blue book, it's kind of obvious that something's up. So anyway, my sobriety date is February 18th, 1990. Marv Greifinger, my first sponsor, had a Monday night men's meeting that began about 22 years ago. At that meeting, he taught us to count our time backwards if we were ever supposed to speak at a group level. He said, count your time backwards because it will ground you and everybody in the room to what he used to call the glorious now. This is a long time before Eckhart Tolle and a lot of wonderful influences that have fallen upon AA. You know, meditation is really popular now in AA, which is a great thing. But so I figured it out on the way up here. I have 3 days, 2 weeks, 5 months, and 23 years of continuous sobriety. Now, before 9/11, we used to say we don't clap for people running out of burning buildings, right? Yeah. But thank you. You're clapping for yourselves, because the deal is it's one day at a time. The analogy I like to use with somebody, if they're relatively new or we're talking, is we're all line and track. And I believe that if we use the great American analogy of the locomotive train, we're all right in the same place. All our engines are right in the same place. It's just that some of us have a little more track behind us, line, than the rest. And the track has gone through sober experience that you can rely on them to share with you. And there's an old blues song that goes, hey, boy, keep the line on the track-a-lacka. Hey, boy, keep a line in the track. Right? And that's what they're talking about. You just keep doing it, man. You know? And everything's going to be okay. So on February 18th, 1990, a very interesting thing happened to me. But Marv was also very, very adamant about sharing what you were like, what happened to you, which means how did you get into AA, and what are you like now? What's the quality of your life like now that you're sober? And the reason that the founders of this program and the first 100 or 200 people realized that that was a really important thing, and this is my belief, but this belief is backed up with sober experience and, you know, conversation with old timers and some reading, not only the big book, but a few other things. What's most important here is how you feel and how I feel and what we have in common emotionally, because the topography, the lay of the land of my pre-sober experience might be bizarrely different than yours. Yours might be completely foreign to me. But I know for a fact, if you're sitting in this room, you're sober by the grace of God, the principles of this program, and the loving prayers of other people, and what keeps you here and what got you here is an emotional experience, not an intellectual experience, a feeling that was secretly hiding something that I need to let everybody in on a little AA secret now. Is there anybody here that's in like their first couple of months, whatever, maybe? Awesome. The great news is you're going to be okay. The bizarre news, because it's not bad news, is you've joined the largest mystical organization, secret society, in the world. It's anonymous, but essentially what this society will do for you because it's done it for me and everybody else sitting in this room, is it will transform your life from the inside and out in a way that you will have no knowledge of how it's working when it's happening. You probably won't be able to see it. Everybody around you will be aware of it before you. And then very subtly, it'll creep up on you. I can't put in a cup, I can't measure for you the transformation that happens to a person who embraces the principles of this program. Now, very interestingly enough, one of our founders got the symbol together. The symbol is a triangle within a circle. It's a mystical symbol. If you want to know the history of this symbol, there's a book called Word and Image by Carl Jung. This is on page 106. Carl Jung, if you read the big book, those of us know he's the eminent physician that Ebby went to. The bottom of the triangle within the circle says recovery. If I can leave you with anything today that's of any value, it's work the steps, because that's what that means. The foundation of this is experiential. It's not intellectual. There's no chapter in the big book called Into Thinking. When I was, well, even now, not when I was new, I could swear there's a chapter in the big book called Into Talking. You know, cleverly defining the problem. All you have is a cleverly defined problem. You have no solution. On the right side is unity. Brothers and sisters, that's what we're doing right now. We're fellowshipping, right? We're at a meeting. On the other side of it is service. I believe that what that means is giving of our time freely to someone else who has the common malady of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I could put a whole lot of energy into building a hospital in Costa Rica. It would be a great thing. I could put a whole lot of energy into feeding a bunch of really poor kids down in Compton or in Appalachia. It ain't going to keep me sober. What's going to keep me sober is taking of my time. Now, service doesn't mean my commitment of convenience where I can just breeze into a meeting and make an announcement and grab my seat 3 minutes before the meeting starts instead of lining up outside like everybody else now. That's not service. That's convenience. By service, we mean, I believe, giving our time. Now, this mystical organization we're in right now has a set of principles that align with the steps. And this ain't going to be an AA chalk talk, but we got to get a few things out of the way here. The bottom line is we can all breathe a sigh of relief and know that everything's going to be okay, no matter what's going on inside and outside of us, because a very, very strange thing happened. In Ohio, about 72 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. Any AA scholars in here? 72 years old, right? 78. Thank you. Anyway, a very, very destructively drinking doctor who would operate on you in blackouts, who was a proctologist. Whoa. Those were some interesting amends that he made the first day after drinking a bottle of beer. Things have changed. And a stock analyst, not a stockbroker, but an analyst, got together and in a book called Not God, which is a very accurate history of Alcoholics Anonymous, people were interviewed. And it was a guy's PhD thesis, and he eventually became one of us. But I strongly recommend it. I know it's not AA literature, and this may sound like blasphemy to some of the orthodox old-timers, but can't hurt. You got to look at Bill Wilson's reading list. He was reading some pretty interesting stuff at the end of his life. But anyway, the guy that wrote this thing interviewed Dr. Bob's wife numerous times, and she said they were sitting in the car, and he said, look, I'm giving this dude I'm giving this guy 15 minutes. He can't help me. No one can help me. And I'm over it. I don't know who this person is and anything. So they spent, 4 or 5 hours? And an amazing thing happened for both of them. They identified emotionally. They didn't identify with much else except how they felt about their drinking and what their drinking did to them, what relief they got, and how the relief turned on them, and then how their lives became incomprehensibly demoralized, right? And they did something very unique that evening. Very, well, not unique, but very American and very mid-century. The word gumption comes to mind. They did something as American as Thomas Edison or the Model T Ford or Chuck Berry or Miles Davis or the Ramones, right? Something uniquely American. Baseball. They said, we got to go find another guy to help. They were enterprising. They knew they were onto something, and they knew they had to give it away to keep it, right? Pretty amazing, right? So if I can leave you with anything, please work the steps. Work the steps with someone who works them with the big book, as well as whatever else they got going on. Take that journey and find other people to be of service to. And stay here. Practice the three sides of our mystical symbol, because what we have here is one of the most powerful transformative forces in the history of humanity. There are things about Alcoholics Anonymous that can be quantified, but the magic that's happening between two alcoholics, when I call up Denny or Steve F. and go, you won't believe what happened. I had a memory come back to me. Were you at Monday night when that happened to me? He was there for me. That's right, I remember now. And, you know, the magic that happens, I'm, again, goosebumps from crown chakra to my feet. We can't measure that magic, but we can measure the results of people's willingness to stay willing. See, willingness can't be measured. It can't be quantified with anything except your actions. That's why they said one day at a time here. The slogans are really important, right? One day at a time is all you have to stay willing, right? And willingness isn't a great condor or a great eagle or a great phoenix rising from the ashes. It's not a big bird of prey going, ah, 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 flying down to scoop you up, you know, and carry you away. Willingness is a little bird. Willingness is like a little peace dove or a sparrow or a hummingbird. You know, it has to be nurtured. It has to be held close, dear to your heart, because it's an emotional experience. So the two guys decide they need to find somebody else. Look what happened. South Bay Roundup. You know how blessed we are. I've been to meetings in 9 foreign countries, I think. I think I've been to meetings in nearly 30 states because of you guys have given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. We're so blessed, right? We really are. We have the most vital, in my opinion, recovery culture, subculture anywhere in the world. You know, people come to our meetings. If there's anybody here from outside Southern California and this is your first experience with us, we welcome you, and we're really happy you're here, and we love you. I love meetings everywhere I go, but I don't know where you can go where this many good-looking people and that many motorcycles and the sun's shining, there's not a drop of rain in the sky, and they're going to rock and roll. They're going to play music. You know, we got a pretty special thing here. So what was I like? Well, I was born at the best time to be born into the circumstances I was born into. I'm 57 years old. I was born in 1955. I was born to two wonderful people. My mother was the family alcoholic, but her credo was, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not addicted to alcohol. I can work at the hospital 7 days a week and not drink. And then my sister and I would say, yeah, but when she comes home, Lord knows what's going to happen day one. And day 5, 6, and 7 were a little sketchy, too. And my dad is the family Al-Anon. They're of that generation that went to World War II. My mother's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. She was a nurse at the Battle of the Bulge. My father is a retired Army colonel. He's 90 years old. He's healthy, happy, and really glad that I'm sober. He's really happy I'm here. I put them through a lot of real tough stuff. I had an older sister who was 6 years older than me, who wasn't an alcoholic. She was a very interesting person. My parents weren't particularly musical. They had about 30, 35 records that they really liked. They liked the pop tunes of the day, Montavani, Mitch Miller, that kind of stuff. Big bands. You know, my dad liked his big bands. My dad liked the Mills Brothers a lot. But my mom was a bit bohemian. She discovered Woody Guthrie, which led her to Bob Dylan, and she really liked Lenny Bruce. I went for comedy, so she'd hang out, smoke cigarettes, chain smoke, martinis, and kind of bohemian from New York. So I was born when my sister was playing piano 3 to 5 hours a day, 5 days a week minimum. And by the time she was 14, she was the Russian Romantic composers, Tchaikovsky, Scriabin, that kind of stuff, piano concertos, but basically not welcome at any piano competitions anywhere we live because she would sweep it. So anyway, there was a feeling when I was a kid that something was wrong. The restless irritability and discontent that we talk about. This may be the genetic predisposition. It may have already been the disease of perception. I may have been getting all the love I needed, but the young budding alcoholic may have seen otherwise. Some interesting things happened to me when I was a child that set me up to feel very separated from people. And being a military family, we moved around quite a bit. And kindergarten through second grade were a bit odd because I had white blonde hair and we lived in Honolulu and my parents sent me to a Catholic school in downtown and they did not believe that what was going on there. And when I would tell them stories of the racial violence that was directed towards me, they just didn't accept it because they had gone to Catholic schools in the inner city.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
But a couple of flashpoints happened, right? There was something about music that changed the way I feel and felt back then. There's a book called This Is Your Brain on Music that describes people like me and my sister. They estimate roughly 7.5% to 12.5% of any utilitarian population that's got free time, like us, Europe, people like that, you know, the privileged world. About 7.5% to 12.5% of us think and feel in Technicolor when we talk about music, when we listen to music, when we play it. This has not stopped for me since I was a kid. In fact, it's grown dramatically in sobriety. The only time it diminished is when my alcoholism was in full bloom. When it diminishes in recovery, it's when the bedevilments on page 52 have got me, when I'm dry, when I'm not recovering. Because you want to know the great news about sobriety is it does get better. Here's the bad news. If you don't nurture your recovery, there's no static state here. We're like trees. We're either withering or we're growing. And the disease will tell you you're sitting still when you're not. You're withering. And the disease is fatal. Jails and institutions are a step to death. Regrettably, most of us are pretty resilient. It takes us a long time to die. But I don't know, in our tribe, I go to meetings on the west side of Los Angeles, some in the valley. We've buried a lot of people in the past couple of years. It's remarkable, and I may get to that. What happened for me was a feeling of separation, a feeling of less than, a feeling of as I am not enough, which in our literature tells us that is the great lie that drives every alcoholic before we begin to recover. It's what we build the false personalities on. It's a platform. As I am not enough. And it's not the truth. Sticking out of it, there's the first secondary lie. I'm afraid of losing what I've got. Sticking out of it over here is I'm afraid of not getting what I want. On top of that, we build layers and layers of false persona based on a disease of perception. Right? That alcohol and drugs actually give us relief from. So the trick is what to do once we stop drinking, right? What, how can we modify our behavior so that we have a spiritual experience, so that we can connect with a higher power, a power greater than ourselves, which, thank goodness, most of us choose to call God, right? I went to this meeting called the Godless Heathens. They were grumpy. They were a bunch of Grumposaurus Rexes, you know, empiricists, scientists, mayor, you know. As I am, I'm not enough. Afraid of losing what I got, afraid of not getting what I want. That's what I was. Had some very interesting, bizarre, my first drug experience was crazy. This kid in the sixth grade said to me, hey, if we take a comb and break the bristles off it and stick it in a cigarette, break the filter off it and smoke it, we'll pass out like the hippies in San Francisco. Pass out? That sounds like a good idea. I don't have to deal with humans. Right, on the way home from school, dodge the bullies and don't have to worry about being so embarrassed to be around the girls. Right? Didn't have any girl skills. Passed out. Very strange. Since it's a musician's meeting, I think this is relevant. I went home and I had one of those turntables that pops up, the record players that played these things called 45s. They're little plastic discs that were next to impossible to duplicate, that everybody who made them got paid for. Yeah, it's great. The people that wrote the song got paid for it. The people that played the song got paid for it. The people that manufactured it got paid. The people that distributed it got paid. What a good business model. Thank you, Internet. I don't know how I've survived, especially since 2008. But anyway, and I put I Can See for Miles by The Who on the turntable, a little 45, and I listened to it about 20 times until my mother came upstairs and said, please listen to something else. You're driving us crazy. And you know what happened that day? Can I swear, or is that not appropriate? Well, we're being taped, so I'll censor it. But the phrase, F you, took on real meaning for the first time in my life. She closed the door, and being the little weasel behind the back loser that I was, I went, F you, behind her back. Because this, the ramifications of doing that to her face would have been very, very costly. Many privileges lost. Anyway, then my first drunk, we moved back to Germany, and I drank a wine with my friends. I had a little band already, my first band, and the drummer and the guitarist and I went out in the woods to camp out and plot world domination. And I just decided to buy two bottles of wine. And I didn't learn this at home. One for me, one for them. It had to be in my genetic memory or in some past life experience or something, you know. And we bought these two bottles of wine, shoved the cork down into the thing. I hadn't drank with anybody. I just, you know, upended it into my gullet like some Bacchanalian rite, straight to blackout. Now, this brings a very important point. This is a threefold disease, physical, mental / emotional, and spiritual. A blackout indicates probably an allergy to alcohol. If a little bit of alcohol made me black out, right? But more importantly, our founders were adamant to stress the physical aspect of the disease when working with new people and kind of put the spiritual stuff on the back burner. And the emotional stuff was about identifying, how do you feel, man? I feel crazy. Okay, let's talk about it for a minute. The reason they stressed the physical was because it's measurable. You can measure a person's physical recovery. They get better. They're able to walk. They're able to talk. They're able to, you know, get to work. They're not having the DTs. They're not in withdrawal from narcotics or whatever. The reason they stressed the emotional, right, because they were in on a big, big secret that a lot of us forget. Every emotion has a beginning, a middle, and an end, right? And if you can talk to someone, you can identify where you're at. Are you in the beginning of it, the middle of it, and is it going to pass like the weather? And then once a person is physically sober and starting to get some emotional sobriety, it's pretty easy to start stressing the spiritual, because the spiritual can't be quantified except in the actions and the results of those actions, right? It's pretty amazing stuff these guys did. They figured it out pretty quick. Like, the book was written, 4 to 5 years into Bill's recovery. Pretty amazing. And the first 100, pretty much everybody had editing rights. That means the first 164 pages, right? This is the big book, my second one that I had with Marv. I transcribed all my notes into it from him. and from some other people, because I use this book when I'm going through the steps with someone. But we can't even get four people after a meeting to agree on where to go have a cup of coffee. And they agreed on 164 pages, pretty much, by group, you know, conscience, basically. Now, those drug and alcohol experiences, I didn't drink for a long time, but I did drugs every chance I could. And back then, under the circumstances I was living in on Army bases, playing in a band with a colonel for a father, you had to be really careful, because had I been caught, particularly overseas, it would have cost him his career. And by my drug experiences, my drinking experiences started in the seventh grade. My drug experiences started in the sixth grade. This is what a doctor would call a gamma familial alcoholic. Gamma meaning it started in my early adolescence. Family, my mom was an alcoholic, right? But by the ninth grade, 18 months into my active drug use and alcoholism, my father sat me down and he said, "You got to go." And I said, "What do you mean I got to go?" He said, "You have two delinquent reports. If you want details on those, they're kind of goofy, funny things that we did that we got in big trouble for, that we were really high, but we didn't get busted." He said, "If you get one more delinquent report, I lose my command authority, and I'll get shipped out of this command, and I'll get transferred to Vietnam. And the mortality rate for field grade officers in Vietnam right now is more than 50%, son, so I'm not interested. I'm retiring in a year and a half." He was going to max out his retirement. So my first geographic was forced upon me, and being the good alcoholic that I am, I chose the most expensive boarding school in Switzerland unknowingly and said, "I'll go there," and nearly bankrupted my parents financially, because that's how selfish I was, self-centered, you know, fear-based. If I were to have done a long-form step 10 that night, let's take a look at that one. There's 11 things in the long-form step 10. Was I resentful? Yeah. Was I selfish? Very. Was I dishonest? Yeah. Was I afraid? Yeah. Did I owe an apology? Yes to everybody. Right? Et cetera, et cetera. Right? These guys dialed it in, man. Had I gotten sober that evening and maybe, you know, been introduced to this stuff, the outcome would have been different. So that was the beginning of a run that started in the seventh grade that ended when I was 34 years old when I got sober to stay. During that time, I managed to graduate from a rather prestigious music school, but I had to relearn how to read music when I got sober. During that time, this sister of mine, who was not an alcoholic, brilliant pianist, on January 2nd, 1980, she was 3 months pregnant, she was killed by a drunk driver. I got sober in 1990. Think about that. I could have perpetrated that same injury onto somebody else's family, very easy. Maybe 300 nights a year, maybe 350, right? That's cunning, baffling, and powerful. You see how these guys, these founders, figured this out, right? When Marv told me that how cunning and baffling and powerful was, he told me that. He said, your sister died in 1980, and it's 1990, and you're getting sober finally? Man, you could have done that to somebody else. See how cunning and baffling and powerful this thing is? You don't want to make somebody feel like you feel when that happened, do you? And I said, no, I don't. That's the willingness. But I wouldn't have had the experience of identification had Marv, Bob, Doug, Dallas, Tony, countless other guys, Denny, just doing a check-in with me, Steve F. It's really a long list. The identification, how do you feel? You know, I played in bands all the time. This is a musician's meeting, but there's probably a fair amount of non-musicians here. Ain't going to help you stay sober for me to give you what I call the podium resume. You know, you don't need to know what I've achieved. What you need to know is that I was incomprehensibly demoralized. I was what Cubby Selby used to call a scream looking for a mouth. I was in so much pain, and I had no identity. And I was separated from the higher power, the good old HP, man. And if you got any doubt whether or not God exists or something, we'll talk after the meeting about that. I love you for it, and I want to hear all about it. I'm good with it, okay? And I'll tell you about my higher power, which I choose to call God, which you guys have helped me find and develop and maintain a relationship with. So I got strung out in New York bad. There was an intervention that was very awkward. My mom and dad, about 3 years after my sister was killed, excuse me, vomited in the sink because I just smoked some heroin. I opened the door, and my mother and father were standing there in my little hovel on 10th Street. And my mother said to me, "Son, you have stolen $10,000 from us in the past 6 months via credit cards. That you're not the son we raised. We don't know what's wrong with you, but we got to help you." And that began my journey here. Very awkward intervention. I didn't get sober. I kicked at my mom and dad's house in Florida. And it was strange, man. And I decided to become my dad. I joined the Air Force. I snuck into officer training school at the age of 28. Now, do I look like officer material to you? No. And it wasn't a good idea. Nobody thought it was a good idea. My mom and dad didn't think it was a good idea. My friends didn't. The neighbor's dog didn't think it was a good idea. You know, I did manage to get stationed in Southern California. It was my ticket out here. You know, and what happened was, is I learned very quickly that my favorite combination back in the day was mild psychedelics and opiates at the same time. You can't accomplish that or approximate that with alcohol. You can try. But what happened to me was I drank a hole in my stomach. I suffered a perforated ulcer on stage at the Troubadour. This is a bottom. Wearing a wig, a fake Rolex, a flight suit that wasn't issued to me, driving a black Corvette with a bile stain on the door from my driving drunk and puking. You know, with no conscious contact with anything other than my own fear. That's how I came to you, okay? I am a hair weave survivor. I came to you with a hair weave. And wondered why no one of the opposite sex was interested. I mean, you had to look pretty close to say, to get it, but you know, I was a mess, and I wasn't a beautiful mess. I was a tragic, sad, pain-stricken, grief-stricken, lonely, frightened, alcoholic. I did manage to achieve a few things out there, but negligible. The perforated ulcer got my attention. I didn't drink or use for 13 months. The gentleman who brought me to Doug F.'s house had been in a really big band for a minute. He realized I was getting out of the military in 3 months. He and I had played together before he had been in that really big band, and he came from London to L.A. or Riverside County, where I was living at the time, and said, "Hey, let's put the band back together, like the Blues Brothers." And we decided to celebrate, and I drank for the first time in 13 months, and I blacked out just like the first time I drank. That really got my attention. I went out on the track to run off a horrible hangover that was caused by about 2 inches out of a pint of Jack Daniel's. So what's that, maybe, you know, less than an ounce of alcohol. That hangover was horrific. That is physical alcoholism. The emotional alcoholism, the as I am not enough of ism of that whole deal is obvious to everybody. The spiritual malady through working the steps has been revealed to me what that is. What was going on there? It was separation from God, man. It was separation from you guys. Anything that puts a wedge between you and someone else puts a wedge between you and God. We're here to take the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and our primary purpose into our families, into our communities, and out into the world. And be a force for change and transformation, mystical transformation, just like the steps mystically transforms us. And Lord knows this world needs us now than ever. Now, if your higher purpose is just to keep helping other alcoholics, what better higher purpose? If your higher purpose, parallel to your primary purpose, is to just be the best sober mom or the best sober dad or the best sober son you can be, what better higher purpose? If your higher purpose is more lofty and you want to cure global warming, great. It's good. Do it sober. Take these principles out there. This will propel you into the fourth dimension, rocket you into the fourth dimension, just like Bill said, right? So the drinking episode was bad. I went out to the track to run off my hangover, and ran the first mile. The second mile, something stopped me. And the world got as quiet as this room was right there for a couple of seconds, and I heard a disembodied voice say to me, if you can figure out a way not to drink or use one day at a time, all your dreams will come true faster than you can imagine. And I went, who was that? It wasn't my voice. It was disembodied. It was you. It was you speaking to me through the Jungian superconsciousness, because I had been to two meetings. Right? That's what I believe. I went, one day at a time. I heard that at that weird AA meeting my friends took me to. My first AA meeting? Weird. Central Florida, kicking dope. I weighed 186 pounds at the time. I'm at my fighting weight now. Around 150, 155. This is normal me. Uncle Fester on crackle. I was big guy, like carrying a lot of beer weight and stuff. Kicking weight, you know. Anyway, the first meeting I went to, I rarely tell this story. It was a round robin. A guy from the Outlaws motorcycle gang. Any Outlaws here tonight? He was wearing his colors, Outlaw Central Florida. Round Robin, it comes to him. He goes, ugh, I'm having a hard time. I drank this morning. This scrawny little Florida old timer with like 30 years, all weathered leather skin from like he worked down at the port. I think he was a fisherman or something. He goes, shut up. You can't share. You drank this morning. This guy's like 6'4", sitting there sprawled out. He goes, oh, man, I got to talk to somebody about this. I've been drinking. This ain't good. I'm going to bust my parole. I can't go home to my old lady. The guy gets in his face. He walks across the circle. He gets in his face. He goes, shut up. I told you to shut up. The outlaw stands up and goes, nobody tells me to shut up, especially when I'm wearing my colors. And the guy goes, I don't give a goddamn about your colors. You sit down, shut up, and listen. On my sister's grave, on my mother's grave, the outlaw picks up his folding chair, goes whap, and boom, hits the guy and knocks him down. My introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. Good reason to stay away. Welcome to Florida AA in like 19, what was that, 84. I just went, my friends, my two musician friends are going, hey man, it's not usually like this. You know, usually there's hot chicks here. It's a program of attraction. You're going to be fine. Right. I'll just join the Air Force. Anyway, and I'd gone to another meeting. My dear, dear friend Peter T, who's sober 30 years now, Torp, right? Took me to a meeting up in San Francisco when I was in the Air Force. That one day at a time, the slogan stayed with me. And I ran home and I woke this guy up and I said, hey, that band you used to be in, I can tell they're sober because the way they talked on MTV, they took some awards and they used that word, that phrase, higher power. The singer said, we're higher powered now. I need to call their manager. I need to go to AA. And he goes, yeah, call Tim. Call him in Boston. So I called this fellow and I said, hey, you may not remember me. My name's Paul. And I played on one of your band's records. It was absolutely the worst record they ever made. I need to go to AA. And said I should give you a call. And he goes, oh, Paul, I remember you. We've been saving you a seat. Now, in my 34-year-old, hungover, delusional, drunk, fear-based, broken as I am not enough mind, immediately flips. And what I saw, really, was a really nice room like this with really attractive people like this. But we were all in director's chairs. And mine said Paul Ill on the back. It was tan. It was brown. I really thought there was a chair with my name on it. Cool, Tim. Where's my chair that you're saving? Where's my seat? He goes, oh, just call Doug. Get his number from, you know, and we'll hook it up. And that began my journey here. What it's like now is I'll give you the recap. First 10 years were very, very difficult for me in most ways. I really didn't manifest much, but I kept betting on myself, and I stuck close to people that were betting on me, right? After 10 years of sobriety, things started to manifest outwardly that indicated to me that things were going to be okay inwardly and vice versa. You know what I mean? Things started to feel pretty good. Since 2000, my mom died in 2006. That was real tough. We'd become pretty close at the end of her life. What it's like now, it's this grand adventure, and it's an unbelievable journey. I'm shocked and amazed that I can make a living doing what I love to do in a climate that's very strange right now for us. I have a really, really good feeling about humanity. I have a really good feeling about people. Nobody wants me dead. There's not anybody I'm hiding from. None of my ex-girlfriends are pissed off. I really have tried to get married. I thought by now I'd have the future former Mrs. Hill in the rooms too. But it hasn't happened yet. Who knows? Got to keep trying, just like everything else. And I continue to do my best to try to remain teachable and to be open to the glorious now and the wonderful experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a canned speaker. I don't have the same talk every time I talk. I'd like to end a little early if that's okay, so we can get to the music and have some fun. All right, is it okay if we end on an up note? And let's welcome the new folks here, and let's share love with one another, and remember that the principles of this program, the founders of this program, really, really brought this thing home for us, and we're here to carry their legacy out into the world. Thank you.
This recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.